Iraq is only now starting to come to terms with the war's most brutal period of sectarian violence. Some call it the Civil War from 2006 to 2008. Many children during that time saw their only family members kidnapped, tortured, and executed. Most recently, orphanages are filling up with children orphaned by attacks from insurgent groups like Al-Qaeda. NPR's Kelly McEvers reports from Baghdad.
Hamid Abid Ali is a handsome little 12-year-old, all freckles and teeth and shiny brown hair. But he also has scabs on the side of his face from picking and scratching when he gets nervous or sad. Hamid says his mother went out for a walk one day and ended up in a hostile neighborhood of Baghdad. A few days later, the phone rang in Hamid's house. "Are you Sunni or Shiite?" the caller said. Hamid's father didn't answer. "Well, if you don't come to pick up your wife, we'll blow her up with the other Shiites." A few days later, that's exactly what they did. Hamid's relatives told Hamid that terrorists strapped a suicide vest to his mother and detonated it.
"My father, who has asthma, was crying so much from the loss of my mother. He went outside and he couldn't stand the dust. They took him to the hospital, but there was nothing they could do to help him, and he died."
Now Hamid lives at this orphanage in North Baghdad. It was opened 4 years ago by a well-respected Shiite cleric.
It's the barbershop.
Exactly.
Hamid says he's happy here. He can play and laugh with his friends. But at night, when he's alone, he says he cries himself to sleep. Bershan Adil also has trouble sleeping. He watched as his father, mother, and brother were kidnapped by insurgents. He never saw them again. Bershan's answers are flat, his face deadpan. He says he doesn't even really miss his parents. After Bershan leaves the office, orphanage director Abu Jaffer tells us the boy has a violent streak, that he hits other kids and calls them names.
"So whenever we see him in such situation, of course, we do follow certain techniques or ways just to absorb his anger. For instance, either to embrace him, to have him in our lap, or sometimes we bring a story or a certain chatting with him just to make him think of something else, just to ease him down, just to absorb his anger."
In some ways, this is the way you deal with things here, Iraqis say. When something bad happens, the best thing to do is try and forget it. But in other ways, the kids here aren't dealing with the violence because there's no one who's trained to help them do it. The director himself has a military background. He admits his staff lacks the proper education and that an orphanage that serves 60 kids is barely scratching the surface in a country where millions of children have lost their parents to violence. One place where children can seek treatment is this ward in the government-run Children's Hospital. It's headed by Haider al-Maliki, one of only a handful of child psychiatrists in the whole country. Children come here for evaluations, therapy, and sometimes drugs. Maliki's own research suggests that nearly three-quarters of Iraq's children suffer from symptoms related to post-traumatic stress disorder. He says violence is so commonplace here, people have come to think it's normal.
"Our children and even our families have adapted the situation. It is okay for them to see some of them being killed or injured or threatening, and after a few minutes, everything is returned to normal."
The plan is for Maliki to train more psychiatrists and counselors and open a separate clinic just for child psychiatry. The new clinic has been approved by the government, but the funding has yet to come through. Maliki says the more children suppress their experiences, the worse off society will be.
"So we think our generation, there will be after 10 to 15 years, when they will grow into adults, they will be a violent population."
"I've said it many times, but I'll say it again," Maliki says. "With this war, you got rid of one Saddam, but you created a million Saddams." Kelly McEvers, NPR News, Baghdad.
This is All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. From the title Animal Kingdom, you might think the Australian film that opens today in New York and Los Angeles is a nature documentary. Bob Mandela says it is a story about survival of the fittest, just not in the great outdoors.
When we first see 17-year-old Josh Cody, he's sitting with his mom in a suburban Melbourne apartment watching TV. He's absorbed enough in his game show that until the medics arrive, you don't register that his mother isn't breathing. A heroin overdose probably wasn't much of a mom. So it says something that Josh will now go to live with a family she'd spent most of her life trying to protect him from. Uncles for whom even a casual traffic stop with a stranger talking tough from another car.
Hey, you got a stereo? Problem,
prompts an instinctual rush for dominance. Violence is so ingrained with this family that on his first day with them, Josh gets handed a gun and told to act like a predator.
Go get him. And do what? Let him know he's king.
So Josh steps out of the car.
Come on, come outside!
And points the gun.
Hey, whoa, 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 brother. Just relax, man. I'm just gonna have a chat to him, all right? Just chill, bro. Get out of here, man. Bit of fun, huh?
Welcome to the jungle, suburban style. White picket fences and beasts of prey. If Josh's uncles are thugs, they're wildly differing thugs. The one egging him on there actually qualifies as their class act. There's another who's forever hopped up on drugs, and one who'd probably be better off if doctors could get his drug mix right. They're all casually lethal, but it's their mom, the queen bee of this brood you shouldn't take your eyes off, a granny who dresses too young, whips up energy shakes as her boys plot crime sprees, and tops them all for sheer cold-bloodedness. She has for decades watched over her children, and no one, not even this new grandchild who's come into her life, can be permitted to endanger them. She makes that clear with an eerie mildness when Josh gets spirited away to a police safe house, and she goes not to a lawyer, but to a corrupt cop.
Tell me if you agree with this. This boy who's being looked after, he knows who you are. And you've done some bad things, sweetie. Haven't you? It shouldn't be too hard to set up a raid on the house. There'd be reasonable grounds, what with all the strange activity, the comings and goings day and night. One of the neighbours might have seen a gun or something. This is your area of expertise. I'm not trying to tell you how to suck eggs. I feel sick about this. I'm not happy at all. Not one little bit. But we do what we have to do. We do what we must.
Actress Jackie Weaver hasn't been heard of much in this country since appearing 35 years ago in Picnic at Hanging Rock, but this part in Animal Kingdom may change that. The film also features Guy Pearce as a low-key detective who tries to help Josh, and newcomer James Freshville as the increasingly endangered teenager. First-time writer-director David Michaud reportedly worked for 8 years on his screenplay, deepening its tale of a violently dysfunctional family until its gangster conventions feel as if they're in the service of a modern-day Greek tragedy. Well, Australian tragedy, though Animal Kingdom, as its title implies, feels pretty universal. I'm Bob Mondello.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. 3 years ago, I received an email from a listener that was so moving, so haunting, it stayed with me ever since. John Whitmer had heard my series of conversations on women at war and the debate over whether women are in fact serving in combat roles. He wrote this.
Thanks for your series on women in combat. My daughter, Specialist Michelle Whitmer of the 32nd MP Company, was killed in action in Baghdad in the early morning hours of April 10, 2004. At the time, she was in the gunner turret of her Humvee, manning a SAW, a machine gun capable of firing 750 rounds per minute. She and her squad were convoying to a police station that had been the target of insurgent attacks. Their mission was to protect the station. On the way, they drove into an intense three-block-long ambush. As Michelle positioned the gun to return fire, she was hit in the shoulder. The trajectory of the bullet caused it to pass through her heart. Does any of this sound like a support role to you?
Michelle Whitmer was the first female member of the National Guard killed in combat. Now, 6 years after his daughter's death, John Whitmer has written a book about her service and that of his other two daughters, Rachel and Charity, who also served in Iraq. The book is called Sisters in Arms, A Father Remembers. I asked John Whitmer how he was able to piece together what happened to his daughter.
Part of it initially was the letter that one of the soldiers that was with her that night sent us. He talked through it, the events of the night, and basically told us how she died. And then later on, and it was many years later before I could face this, I did request the reports that were filed that night. It took several years to get them, but eventually I got them, and I read through the reports and just kind of corroborated what everybody had told us as far as what she was up to and what she was doing. And here's the other interesting thing. There were three vehicles in that convoy that she was in. All three vehicles had females in the gunner turret.
You said you went and you read through the reports. Did you have to go someplace special, sit in a room all alone with that document on your lap?
I remember actually taking a chair and going into a very small office and closing the door. And just, I didn't tell my wife that I actually got them. It was days before I could tell her that they actually came in the mail. I had to read them myself before I would decide if I would tell her. And to this day, she's never read them, and I don't want her to. But it was something I felt I needed to do. And it was very hard.
In the book, you go back and revisit some very, very difficult moments. You write with great candor about the hours and really the minutes after you first got the terrible news about your daughter, Michelle. Your first instinct was to get your other daughters back home.
Absolutely. I think any parent in the same situation, I believe, would feel the same way. You just had this tremendous loss. A part of you has been torn out. Later, people would accuse us of being unpatriotic. At the time, it didn't even go that deep. It was just I had to protect my daughters. And I think, you know, later on you understand, if you've read through, that I had to come to grips with the fact that it wasn't my decision, that my daughters had to make that decision. And as much as my instincts were to protect them, they were grown up now. They were soldiers.
You were seeking a compassionate reassignment, and your daughters didn't necessarily think that was a good idea?
They didn't know. They just wanted time to think about it. In the end, the decision was taken out of their hands in some respects, because all the publicity around the request created an atmosphere where we felt that, and the National Guard felt, that they might actually bring danger to their fellow soldiers because they were so high profile. We'd actually gotten death threats, people identifying themselves as part of the insurgency, saying that if they saw them again, that they would make them a target.
Mm. When your daughters first joined the military, what was your knowledge of what women might possibly be doing, and then how did that square with what you ultimately learned by going back and examining what they actually did in Baghdad?
Well, first of all, they were reservists. So I always thought reservists filled in behind the regular army as they were deployed. And then I thought, as far as females, they would always be in some type of support role. And like I said in the book, I imagined them sitting at some supply depot signing trucks in and out. Then I began getting emails from them in Baghdad and began understanding that they're convoying through cities, they're going on raids, they're defending police stations. You know, it was quite a shock. And I think it wasn't until I began to get those first letters home from Baghdad that it sunk in, that that's what female soldiers do nowadays. It should have registered when I went to their basic training graduation, and they explained that they had all the same training as their male counterparts, same weapons training, same physical training. They were prepared to do what they did.
You suggest that the country should reconsider what it means to have women in combat. What specifically should be reevaluated?
I don't know if reconsidered is quite the word I'm looking for. I think what we need to do is own up to the fact of what our female soldiers are doing and fully respect it. I am not one who says that women don't belong in combat. My daughters were full-grown women who made choices and decided that this is the way they wanted to serve. And again, some people would argue that they weren't in combat. And this is where it gets all dicey and I get a little frustrated. You know, when you're in a war that doesn't have a front line, all those old rules go out the window. And I guess when we say reconsider, that's what I want people to reconsider. There aren't any front lines in many of these wars that we're engaging in today. So the rules that seem to be segregating what men's roles are and what women's roles are, they don't apply anymore. So let's own up to that, and let's acknowledge what our female soldiers are doing, and let's respect it.
What don't people understand about what you go through, particularly as time goes on?
Well, I think the first thing they don't understand is what it's like for a family to wait. We were in the support group for the 32nd MPs, and I'll tell you the stories that you hear of people trying to cope, you know, moms with three kids whose husband, who had a good job, is now over making military pay and trying to keep the business that he ran together while taking care of the household. We don't understand the sacrifices as a country of what our families go through. That's number one. Number two is when we do lose a soldier, if I can get just one person to understand what that statistic means when it's read over the news or it's reported in the newspaper, I feel like in some way I've done what I want to do. Because I think when you fully appreciate the cost of war, then you go to war more carefully. I want people to understand what the true cost is, and I want them to make sure that we spend the lives of our soldiers very, very carefully.
John Whitmer, thank you very much for talking to us. All the best to you and all the best to your family.
Thank you.
John Whitmer, his book is called Sisters in Arms, A Father Remembers. Researchers are tracking a massive chunk of ice, four times the size of Manhattan. It has broken away from Greenland's Petermann Glacier. The giant island of ice is now drifting south toward Canada. This is the biggest Arctic glacier break since scientists began monitoring them 50 years ago. One of the scientists keeping watch is Jason Box, a professor of geography at The Ohio State University. He's a frequent visitor to the Greenland ice sheet. I asked him what it sounds like when such a big chunk of ice breaks off.
Well, a lot of times it's too windy to hear it. But if you're lucky, the wind's down and it sounds like a rumbling. Some have likened it to the rushing of water. But what I've heard, it sounds more like a cannon going off.
Why does this happen? Why do these big chunks break off?
Well, it's been conventional thought that air temperatures were very important, and they probably are. But we're learning recently that small changes in ocean temperatures are much more important because water contains so much more heat. A small change just increases the melt rates underneath the glacier, and it can melt 100 times faster below the water surface than in the air.
Is there anything that they can do to break it up?
Well, I'm aware of some studies in the past. The military have tried to, torpedo icebergs, but it has very little effect. And tugboats have been unable to move these fragments around either because they have a really deep keel, and ocean currents will just drag the tugboats around.
Would they ever run ashore? I mean, could they fuse to land?
Yeah, that's conceivable. However, the keels on these things, you know, 9/10 of the thickness is below water, so they will just run aground before they would impact the shoreline.
Is there a connection between these glacial breaks and the rising temperatures around the globe?
Yeah, I think there is a connection, and it's because we observe dramatic increase in the sea surface temperatures at the same time that the sea ice, the frozen seawater around this area, has declined significantly during the summer. And then when we average the 30 widest glaciers in Greenland, they collectively show a very consistent retreat pattern. There are physical processes like the meltwater ponding on the surface of the glacier that can actually cut down through the ice because water is heavier than ice. And then it just takes some wind to blow these fragments apart. And so I believe that we understand well enough to link this with global warming.
Now, this was not altogether unexpected. People had been predicting that a fairly large island of ice would break off from the Petermann Glacier. Are there other large chunks that could break off from the glacier?
Yeah, there's another Manhattan-sized chunk that seems liable to break next because it has this even wider crack that we called the Big Kahuna. I've got some photos of it. It's an enormous crack. And, that could happen this year.
Why do I get the sense that you wake up in the morning and run to your computer to take a look at this?
Yeah, that's actually true. I'm highly
motivated.
I had
a feeling.
Well, it is very exciting to observe these enormous changes. And it's relatively easy these days with computers and the internet. I can pull up a 3-hour-old image of the area, and that's what we've been doing this summer, waiting for this to happen. And it's just, kind of thrilling in an ominous way when something like this happens. But we could see it coming. We were just waiting for it.
Professor Box, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
That was Jason Box, an associate professor at The Ohio State University.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's your chance to sound off in a few minutes. Our digital media guy, Lee Hill, says you all had plenty to say about my commentary this week. Our Back Talk segment is coming up. But first, our Faith Matters conversation. That's where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality. Today we want to talk about Ramadan. The Muslim holy month for this year started this week on the evening of August 10th. Observant Muslims fast from sunup to sundown, abstaining from food and water. The time is spent in spiritual reflection. Now, much is made of the fasting aspect of Ramadan, but we are going to let you in on a little secret. It turns out that Ramadan might be one of the best times of the year for good eating because when sundown comes, the fast is broken, sometimes with sweets prepared especially for this time of year. So we wanted to know more. So we've called Abdullah Fawaz, executive chef of the Mediterranean Bakery and Cafe. That's in Alexandria, Virginia. That's right outside Washington, D.C. And joining us from Dearborn, Michigan, is Abbas Umar, manager of the Al Amir restaurant. Welcome to you both. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having us.
Do you find it funny that many non-Muslims are so intrigued by how you managed to get through the month? Mr. Fawaz, do you want to answer that? Do you know what I mean? Or you get questions like, how do you handle it?
The best answer will be if you have faith in God and Iman, that will keep you going.
Okay. And Mr. Umar, what about you?
Sleep during the day and wake up at night.
Okay, very well. So we have the practical and we have the transcendent. There you go. We have both. And may I ask, is it difficult working in the restaurant industry when you're abstaining?
Yes, it is, especially when you are fasting and making all these goodies and kinafas with cheese, with cream, all this. But yes, very difficult.
How do you manage not to, you know, sneak a taste?
Well, think about God, other people, you know, the poor people, they might not have all this food we are doing or we are eating here. And just bear your minds with them and hopefully God will help them and have, like in Pakistan, Afghanistan, you know, with the flood and all this, God with them, you know, that's the best. But for here, I mean, we thank God for all this food around us.
And that was Mr. Fawaz. Okay, Mr. Umar, what about you? How do you manage to stay focused and not sneak a little taste or something?
I mean, I really just try to stay busy. Like you said, I try to keep it as practical as possible.
Okay.
I mean, I know it's a religious month and we're doing it for all the right reasons, but got my eye on the prize and keep chugging along.
I hear you. Are you cranky right about now?
Pardon?
Mr. Umar, are you cranky right about now? You're a little cranky when you're really honest. Are you a little cranky?
Well, I mean, in a normal situation, no, because this month is not only about not eating. It's a lot more. It's just about applying yourself and reaching a new level of humanity and reaching a new level of self-awareness.
If we could talk about food for a minute, and I hate to kind of add to your burden, but Mr. Fawaz, why don't you start? Are there some special things that people particularly like to enjoy during Ramadan once the fast is broken?
Sure.
Can you tell us about some of the popular items?
Sure. The most popular item in the Middle East, which we do it only for Ramadan during the year, you don't find it, or rarely you find it, unless, you know, some people order it special. It's called qataif. Qataif, it's like American pancakes, a little bit thinner. And we stuff that, we fold them, and we stuff them with nuts and some cream. And then we bake them lightly baked, and after that dip them directly to honey or a thick syrup. Mm-hmm. And then we decorate it with pistachio and serve it. That's the most popular item in Ramadan. And then, of course, there is the kinafa also with cheese or with the cream. That's semolina dough with the shredded dough. Mixed together. Also, it has a lot of syrup, of course, and decorated with pistachio.
Do non-Muslims come in and during the day and get these items too, or do you close during the day?
Of course. Yeah, no. Of course. Mm-hmm. Of course. They do it. I mean, Americans, they love our food. I mean, and especially when Ramadan, when you have something new, oh, what is this? What's that? And you explain it to them, and they eat it, and they love it. That's no question about it.
Are there?
Our clientele at Alamir is about 60% non-Muslim. So we got a really large clientele base that really we're not really too affected by the Ramadan.
I see. And do the special Ramadan treats, though, Mr. Amar, like Mr. Fawaz was saying, that sometimes the customers who are not Muslim will see that there are special treats on the menu for Ramadan and they'll ask them.
They love it. Mm-hmm. They love when Ramadan comes around.
And what about, God, I hate to be pedestrian about this, but what about baklava? Is that popular at this time of year, or is that just...
It is the other choice, you know, the other kind of choice. Baklava is like... it's a wild variety of things, you know. It's the same principle as a phyllo dough or a shredded dough filled with different kind of nuts or cream or cheese and different shapes. And that goes all year around, you know. And also in Ramadan, people, they like to do that. The kataif, like I said before, and kinefa, is those two items is the most popular in Ramadan.
And what about any particular fillings that people particularly want at this time of year? Is there any particular version that's more popular than other?
They like the cream filling, which is, we call it kashta. Kashta, it's like when you boil the cream, the milk, and you skim that up, you know, thick layers coming out of the boiling the cream, and that you add all this skimming, and you make it like almost like a little lighter than a cream cheese.
It's really close to ricotta cheese.
Exactly.
I see. Yeah. I see. Well, can I ask before I let you go on? You're both very generous with your time because I know you're both really busy. Is there something that each of you particularly likes, Mr. Amar?
You know what I really love, and at our restaurant we have it, it's seasonal. It's only for the month of Ramadan. I just eat a simple date, and I drink some date juice, which we call jalab. And then otherwise than that, it's a free-for-all.
Okay. Just you kind of like ease into it, huh?
Yeah. You know, because you haven't eaten all day, and you have been fasting for 10-plus hours. I don't think chowing down on a hamburger is really good for you, so I just wade into it.
You wade into it with the date juice. I see. Mm-hmm. Forgive me, I've never had it. Is it like prune juice? Is there a flavor I could compare it to? I've never had it. I've had dates, but I've never had date juice.
After the break, you send me your address, and I'll make you some jalab.
Okay. Well, thank you. Mr. Fawaz, what's your favorite thing to break the fast with?
Usually we go break the fast either a cup of water and like a piece or two of dates.
Is that a spiritual thing or is that a cultural thing?
No, it's
or is
a
it
spiritual
a just...
thing. And but
it's spiritual and practical, I guess.
Yes, it is. And on my side, I have a sweet tooth. I go for kataif right after.
You go right there.
Because I make it all day and then I care for it. So I cannot wait.
I think I'm with Mr. Fawaz. I think I'm kind of a go right there person.
Exactly. Just get it done.
Let's get it done. Abdullah Fawaz is the executive chef of the Mediterranean Bakery and Cafe in Alexandria, Virginia. And Abbas Umar is manager of the Alamir restaurant in Dearborn, Michigan. And they were both kind enough to join us their Ramadan secrets with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. Thank you very much.
Some prominent liberals are calling on Congress to approve more stimulus spending to revive the economy. Many conservatives say no, it'd be much better for Congress to make all the tax cuts from the Bush era permanent. Adam Davidson of NPR's Planet Money team says the real economic stimulus won't come from Congress. It's already happening at the Fed, and most people probably aren't aware of it.
The academic debate over whether fiscal stimulus is our only salvation or the worst idea that anyone ever came up with, that debate does not matter because here's just about the easiest prediction someone can make. A fiscal stimulus is not going to happen. There is almost no possible way the Democrats in Congress would go into a tough election by borrowing nearly a trillion more bucks. A second massive stimulus, if it was even thought about, it would be on the front page of every paper. It would lead the nightly news. You'd hear about it on every cable chat show. So imagine how surprising it was that this very week, although there's a good chance you didn't notice, the Federal Reserve did something awfully close to announcing a huge new stimulus. In the height of the crisis, back in January 2009, the Fed started to buy mortgages, a lot of mortgages, $1.25 trillion in mortgage-backed securities. there is a decent chance that the Fed effectively owns your house. The Fed doesn't normally muck about in people's homes. The goal was something called monetary stimulus, but its effect is the same as fiscal stimulus, the kind passed by Congress. They basically have the same idea: get lots more money out into the economy. The Fed plan was to hold those mortgages for a short time and then sell them as quickly as possible. This week, the Fed made a major shift in policy. They said not so fast. Technically, what they're doing is transferring some of the $1.25 trillion from mortgage securities to other types of securities, but the impact is largely the same. Our economy is going to be pushed forward, although maybe not terribly effectively, by a massive monetary stimulus from the central bank. The Fed knows, of course, that most people pay very little attention to Fed announcements. Fed stimulus? That's a snooze on the business pages. Congressional stimulus? You hear people screaming about it all day long on cable news and on radio talk shows. Now, this may be exactly how things are supposed to work. The whole idea of a central bank is to have a group of serious, economically trained folks who are not constantly worried about the next election. And many outside experts do support what the Fed is doing. But it does seem a bit strange that such an important decision received so little attention. Adam Davidson, NPR News.